The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We're fortunate to have Dr. Brian McGinley with us again. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we talked about a lot of great stuff about sleep last week, and it's been so stimulating. I've had a hard time sleeping just thinking about talking to you again. Before we start, do you have any conflicts you'd like to talk about?
I do not have any conflicts.
Okay, and if we happen to talk about any off-label uses of medications, you'll mention that, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. Any medications we're going to talk about with sleep are off-label, so. We'll get that out of the way. Yeah.
Okay, good. So we talked last week about a lot of things having to do with healthy sleep and how to frame healthy sleep. You know, it's fascinating to me. And one of the things I talk about with my patients all the time is nobody ever says, I'm really, really hungry. I wonder if it's because I'm not eating enough. But with sleep all the time, people say, I don't know why I'm so tired, so unfocused, so grumpy. And you look at their sleep schedule and it's terrible. As you pointed out, both very inconsistent and very insufficient. So what we hope to do is give people the wherewithal to be better sleepers and to define themselves as superb sleepers. So let's talk a little bit about that. So you talked about some of the things that we often do to help people have a better bedtime. One of the things that we started to touch on last week is the idea of being a distracted sleeper at bedtime. Are there any distractions that you recommend that people do? I think you touched on the issue of a playlist, for instance. Is listening to music or something else helpful at bedtime, or white noise or anything like that?
Yeah, so promoting activities, I think, whether considered distracting, but things that are non-stimulating, allowing your brain to kind of wind down and not think about or focus on maybe things that were concerning, some interaction in the day, some fear for tomorrow. So we're big fans of things like coloring, writing, drawing, those sorts of things, reading. For some people, that is music, as long as it is kind of relaxing music. Heavy metal may not be the best choice right before bed. But if it's relaxing music, then yeah, I think that's great. You kind of touched on the environment too. That is something that's worth discussing. So where is it that you actually, where do you sleep and what does that look like at night? Ideally, the room should be dark. It should be cool. So high 60s, low 70s is what we promote. Should be quiet. So discussions with folks, are there noises, if the patient's able to answer for themselves, in the house, outside of the house, that you hear that might wake you up or keep you up at night? What is that? And if you're a particularly light sleeper, or if noise is a problem, white noise is fantastic. Drowning out those fluctuations that are arousing, so they wake you back up. Your brain gets alert of those. The other one that we talk a lot about too are pets. So folks who have pets that sleep in the bed with them, that can be very disruptive as well. And advocate actually that you take the pet out of the bed and out of the room if possible. Your brain is constantly trying to make sense of the environment around it, including during sleep. And so if there are these spikes of noise, or you have the pet and the pet rolls over and does something, you're going to respond to that and wake up. And if it's persistent all night, it's not a very restorative sleep.
You mentioned keeping a dark environment. What about the issue of night lights with younger children?
That's a great point. So I think it's here we try and take an approach that it's a discussion. What's the darkest that we can get it where the child still feels comfortable? And that for a lot of kids is the goal. So they've got to feel comfortable. They've got to feel assured that and not scared, because that's going to be counterproductive. But how dark can we get it, and how can we get it to that point for your child to feel safe? The other one is, there are different light sources and different light colors out there. We talked a little bit about blue light, for example, out of computers and screens. Blue light, if you're looking for color light, is probably not the best choice either. And so maybe red for some kids or avoiding that blue spectrum, it can be helpful too.
That's very interesting. Now, coming to the inevitable, a lot of times people will use pharmacologic sleep aid. In my mind, it seems like there is melatonin, there are antihistamines, and then there are a couple of other things that people often prescribe, things like clonidine or trazodone. Tell us a little bit about those. What about the use of melatonin?
Yeah, we use melatonin here. Melatonin is really, it's got a little bit of soporific activity, so sleep-inducing activity, but not tremendous. If I gave you a large dose of melatonin right now, you're not going to lay down and want to go to sleep. What it's really best for is help with manipulating the circadian rhythm, so the natural, the genetically determined time when you go to bed and when you wake up. So if used appropriately a couple hours before sleep or desired bedtime, can be helpful with that. There's an increase in melatonin a couple hours before bed that occurs in all of us naturally. And so we're trying to mimic that. We use it a lot when we're manipulating the clock. So somebody's got a natural tendency to go to bed, let's say at midnight, but, you know, got to get up for school early, bedtime. It would be really helpful if it were earlier. We'll move that bedtime up slowly. And a lot of times we'll use melatonin to help with that process. So we're moving up the dose of melatonin as well. We use 2 to 3 milligrams. It's a pretty low dose. I've seen adult colleagues use higher doses at 10 milligrams or so, but we have pretty good success with lower doses. The other thing we mentioned, it's always important to talk to families about side effects, potentially. The biggest ones, there's some animal studies that showed early onset of puberty in an animal model, but I think the bigger one is really nightmares, and some folks can get nightmares from it. So you want to warn them if that's a possibility, and if it occurs, then to stop and let us know, give us a call back.
Just as an aside, in a world where people could travel, so is melatonin helpful in correcting jet lag?
Absolutely, if used appropriately. Yeah, it's a longer conversation, but yeah, absolutely can be helpful in that process too. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I often frame to my older patients anyway that they're trying to stay in the same time zone all week, and how difficult it is to change that way. And that often makes a little bit of sense to them. Is there a risk for long-term use of melatonin, of suppressing melatonin, or of people not being able to make their own melatonin?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. I don't think there are great studies out there looking at this that I'm aware of anyway. For most folks, we use it for a shorter period of time, like I said, manipulating that sleep onset. I think there's a subset of folks that seem to be, at least anecdotally, particularly susceptible or to it and its effects that might use it a little bit longer. Yeah, so we have used it for several years in some kids.
So if you wander over to the supermarket and are looking for a way to fall asleep, you got melatonin, and now you've got, in general, diphenhydramine or doxylamine. Those are the ones that are marketed for sleep. Tell us about using those in kids.
Yeah, we're not big fans. They're messy drugs in terms of they do a whole bunch of things, and sedation is one of those. The biggest side effect from diphenhydramine is a hangover the next day. So you just kind of feel lousy and still tired when you wake up. Instead, ideally, what we would do is trying to really dig in, and we're happy to do this here, to try and really dig in and understand what those issues are that are preventing sleep, and let's see if we can address those rather than using a medication and not addressing the underlying issues.
So, and then obviously, you know, when we talked to Dr. Carbone a few months ago, he definitely uses a fair amount of melatonin in patients who have autism, but that's kind of a different issue, isn't it?
Yeah. The autism group is a little bit different, and I would put them in a bit of a different category. I agree with you. We see children, we saw a handful last week where families really, well, let me back up here a little bit. The issues with sleep with children with autism are varied. It's not one issue. So some have trouble falling asleep, some staying asleep, some get up too early, some have highly variable schedules. It's really a mixed kind of bag, if you will, in terms of the sleep issues. We've worked with a number of families, and it's evident that you can do all of the things that we've talked about, but follow them to a T if you're a family, all the recommendations about the environment, the routine, the schedule, and still the children with autism, some children with autism have trouble falling asleep and staying asleep. I do think for those kids, there is a role for medication, absolutely. And we've tried to partner with our psychiatry colleagues when we get to that point to use meds that I think are helpful, but for some of us aren't things that we prescribe routinely and aren't as comfortable with.
As a parallel issue with insomnia, there are the kids who either wake up in the night or are waking up far too early in the morning. What do you do about those kids?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, trying to understand if we can, why. Let's say waking up in the middle of the night first. One of the things we'll ask and we'll run through are there issues with breathing? That's a common one. So do you snore? Do you pause? Any restlessness? Do you mouth breathe? These are all signs, symptoms that suggest maybe sleep apnea might be playing a role. So we want to explore that. The other thing that occurs a lot is what happens when you wake up. And so everybody does wake up during the night. We all do. Do you have the ability to kind of soothe yourself back to sleep, get comfortable and go back to sleep or not? And if the cases suggest no, so when I get up or when my five-year-old gets up, their response is to call out for us or somebody else and it's disruptive. Oftentimes it's going back to the bedtime routine. Tell us how that goes. And we get a lot of folks who have that issue, and it's really what the child has learned to do is fall asleep in the presence of a parent. So that's the way we've always done it. Mom or dad lays with me or the child until they fall asleep. That's how they know to soothe themselves to sleep. So the natural response in the middle of the night when you wake up for whatever reason is to call out to mom and dad. And that's disruptive over time as well. So it's really working at that beginning and sleep onset, working on some self-soothing techniques, fading parental presence slowly to help them better soothe themselves back to sleep in the middle of the night. The early morning awakenings can be a little more challenging. The younger ones often we've found helpful. There's something called a good morning light. We've become big fans of it here. So there is a clock with a light that you can program for nighttime hours, and the family can set what those hours look like for them. And the clock will be a one color that changes color when they decide it's daytime and okay to be up and out of the bed. To give particularly younger children or children who aren't able to read a clock cues about when it is okay to, when it is nighttime and I should be in bed, and when it's okay to get up out of bed and join the rest of the family. So some of the younger ones, giving them those cues.
In terms of the self-soothing issues, I've read a little bit about CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy, insomnia. Is that anything you want to comment on? Are there practitioners that you use, or is that a technique that you point people toward?
Yeah, thanks. We've actually started a clinic here, half a day. I think it's going to go to two half a days a week in October. It's us in conjunction with behavioral therapy, and it is cognitive behavioral therapy around issues with sleep. So that is the recommendation, I think, for folks who have trouble sleeping, not able to sleep, independent of sleep apnea or other issues, that we use and rely on heavily to help.
And so if somebody wanted to access that, they could call up to your clinic.
Absolutely. Yep. We usually see them first, run through some of these questions, and if they're a good candidate, we'll refer them to that clinic.
Are there any sleep-related questionnaires that you would recommend for people out in the world?
Yeah, there's a PEDS sleep quality questionnaire that I think is not too lengthy. I want to say it's about 20 questions off the top of my head. Some of these are like 10 pages. I think that's a little onerous for anybody. But this is about 20 questions, I think, roughly, to walk through some of these issues. It's pretty good for sleep disorder. Breathing is a big part of that. That if somebody wanted to institute in a clinic, I think it's easy to fill out.
So as you look at the patients who are referred to you, are there any big issues that you wish you could say to practitioners, here's one thing that I wish you'd consider in patients before they come up here?
It's easy for me to say, but take a couple minutes to really try and get the history in terms of trying to understand what it is that at the core of the difficulty falling asleep. Some of these things we've talked about, the routine, the environment. Mm-hmm. That are helpful. The other thing I'd say is that, and we could talk about this later, but we get a lot of referrals for a sleep study for somebody who doesn't sleep well. I think a sleep study is great for folks who have trouble breathing during sleep, or if there's some unusual movement during sleep and trying to better understand that. But it's not really good at trying to tell somebody how they sleep or how well they sleep. It's a common misconception we get certainly from families. Well, tell me how well they slept. We put you in an artificial environment with a bunch of patches and monitors, a stranger coming in and out of your room all night. I hope that doesn't translate into how you sleep at home.
I can't sleep camping, let alone when somebody stuck wires all over me.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah. And somebody coming in looking over you every 20 to 30 minutes. It's a different environment. So
What about the smartphone and like wrist-based devices that people wear to give them an idea of how well they sleep?
Yeah, I think I like the idea. I like the attempt. I haven't seen any that any of us feel are particularly accurate, is the downside. There are, we use a device here called an actigraph. It's essentially an accelerometer that is in your phone with a light and dark, it can sense light to put together more objectively when people go to bed, when they wake up. But I don't think it's very good at all. That you get information about how much from some of these devices, how much REM sleep or slow wave sleep. I don't think those are accurate, unfortunately. Yeah.
And you know what I think people need? I think they need to have their smartphone closer to them all night.
Yeah, right. And on. And yeah. Yeah. The more phone, the better. That's right.
In general, I think that's the one thing that's missing. Well, you know, it is interesting because I think that part of what ends up happening with kids staying asleep is that, as you pointed out, you know, sleeping with a pet isn't super restful. And I think for parents, sleeping with a child isn't super restful, but thinking about tackling retooling what's happening feels more exhausting than just putting up with where you are.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I agree. That is part of the conversation that if for folks who have gotten into this situation, maybe the child's had difficulty, it's easier to let them just come into my bed and fall asleep with us. Unfortunately, it perpetuates the problem. Talking about the effort that is going to take to untangle this is a conversation worth having. And I think most families get that. They know when you start talking about what's involved. So we're going to get them back in the bed. You're going to slowly fade out of the room. And we talk about how to do that. But it's a commitment. And especially for somebody who's waking up 10, 20 times, we have a night. And working through that with families. It's a huge effort. But the idea, I think, for most, if you're in a place where you can do it, it is beneficial in the long run. So there is some short-term pain, but in the long run, everybody will be better off.
Well, that's very, very, very helpful. This has been very helpful. Next week, we're going to talk about some bad sleep issues and the things you alluded to earlier about things that may need a sleep study. This has been very helpful. We appreciate your time taking out of your busy schedule. Thanks for your expertise. If people have questions, send your questions to questions@bcurb.com and pass those along to Dr. McGinley to respond to in a couple of weeks. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.